Contents of the book, which described the 7 points of mind training. So this is the overview. We've been focused on the first 2 points, and I'd like to, in the time we have left, just bring up a few points from later in the text. But it makes sense maybe to give you an overview if you don't already know this. So the point of the text is to help us to generate compassion and love. Love depends on compassion, because without the ability to take in the suffering of ourselves and others, in the end, our love is severely limited. So it's really about love, but love requires compassion. And it's difficult, as we know, because we don't really want to go in the direction of suffering. We want to go in the other direction. So we need some help and some training. So that's the kind of argument of the text. So there's 7 points for the development of that capacity. And the first one, as we talked about yesterday at length, is resolve to begin, which is the four reflections, or the many other ways that are available to us for examining our motivation more deeply. I mentioned in the book about one of the most effective ways of doing this is all the many 12-step programs that exist. And that's what they do, by through the magic of people telling each other their stories. Just that. But also with the added ingredient of the fact that everybody who shows up to those meetings either is at the moment or in the past has been in dire straits in their lives, which gives them already a tremendous amount of motivation. Right? If your life is falling apart, you have a lot of motivation to change your life. So given that, and given you sitting in a room with other people who also have experienced that and listening to their stories, that is to sit through that for a while is a way of really transforming your life, as we have seen. It is the success of 12-step programs worldwide. They're kind of quiet in a way. You know, they don't advertise, they don't make a big splash. But actually, it's pretty impressive, you know, what has been done. So that's another way of deeply reflecting on your motivation. Resolve to begin. The second point is train in empathy and compassion, and we also spent a lot of time on that yesterday. And that's, remember, the absolute compassion and relative compassion. And these two together, these first 2 points together, we don't finish with them and go on, right? We keep going back to them, because these are the depth and the underlying foundation of for all the very specific and more ordinary kinds of changes we might make in our lives in terms of the way we respond, the way we speak, the way we look at things. They all are assuming this foundation of tremendous depth, depth of feeling, depth of personal motivation, and depth of understanding. And this is a depth that we would continue to cultivate our whole life through. In other words, the extent to which we could increase our love and our compassion is pretty much limitless. We could deepen this our whole lives through. So if you feel like, oh, you know, I don't think I've gone very far, well then, join the club. We all haven't gone very far. We all have a long, long way to go. And so you keep coming back to these first 2 points and to deepening. So the third point is transform bad circumstances into the path. And because, as I always, people, you know, like, it's a very typical thing. Oh, hi, how you doing? I haven't seen you in quite a long time. You used to come all the time to practice, and now it's been a couple of years since I've seen you. What's been going on? Oh, I've been having a hard time. Life's gotten really complicated, and I haven't had time to practice. Because when things get tough, who has time to do spiritual practice? We're too busy. We got to deal with what's going on. We don't have time to practice. Doesn't that happen to us all the time? Because we think of practice as a really nice thing to do for ourselves, like kind of like going to the gym, or it's really good for you. And when you can, you do it. But when things get tough, you don't have time for it because you have to really deal with your life. You can't really fool around with your spiritual practice. I don't know. Oh, maybe it ran out of batteries because I turned it on. Yeah, it looks like it's out of batteries. Okay, I'll speak up. Maybe they can change the batteries. Can you do that? Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So this point says, actually, you got it backwards. Actually, when things get hard, that's the time when your spiritual practice really counts and when you can really develop it, because you have the necessary material, which is a mess in your life. That's what you need. So can you stop thinking of the messes in your life as unfortunate things that we have to get quickly rid of, which of course means you hardly ever get rid of them? Instead of seeing it that way, can you see all the messes in your life as times to practice, as precious opportunities to practice? I was quoting in one of our little groups sometime this weekend this wonderful saying of our founder, Suzuki Roshi, who said, for a Zen student, a weed is a treasure. Not something to be pulled out and thrown away. It's a treasure. So we have to be able to look at our to look at our difficulties that way. How would we do that? How would we turn around our point of view so that we could turn our difficulties into the path? So that's the third point of mind training. The fourth point is make practice your whole life. It's a little bit of a corollary to the first. Don't see practice as something separate from your life. Realize that for a human being is simply a conscious, sacred, living being. There's no way to be a human being and not do spiritual practice. You might not go to a meditation center or a church or a synagogue. You might hate religion and be a committed atheist. But still, you have a spiritual life and a spiritual practice because you live, you die, you're trying to figure out what to do every day as a decent human being. So you're practicing. Make practice your whole life. Understand that your whole life is spiritual practice and see if you can live it accordingly. The fifth point, assess and extend. In your practice, you'll often be off in some way. You won't go in a straight line. You'll be meandering around and things will happen. And you'll be practicing in ways that are not really helpful. So you need some tools so that you can see how you're doing and learn how to get back on track when you lose track. So that's the fifth point, assess and extend. The sixth point is the discipline of relationship. Because again, we are conditioned to think of spiritual practice as a private affair. Spiritual practice is what I do in the privacy of my own mind. But the truth is that we practice in every interaction with one another, and that it's our challenges in meeting one another in this lifetime that really draw forth our practice. And so rather than thinking that everybody else in the world is so bothersome and troublesome, even though we have to admit we need them, we can't get along without them, nevertheless, they're such a problem. Why? Because they're not us. That's the problem with them. So we need to switch that around and realize that every human interaction is a chance for practice. How do we practice the discipline of human relationships? And last point, seventh point, is living with ease in a crazy world. How do we confront the craziness of this world in such a way that we don't make it worse and we don't make ourselves the victims of it? How can we actually enjoy this life? Seeing it for what it is, not pretending it's otherwise than what it is. seeing the world for what it is and not pretending it's otherwise than what it is, and at the same time having some happiness and some ease and some delight. That's really necessary. And how do we do that? So a whole bunch of slogans are for the purpose of helping us with that. So I give you this whole map because now I want to turn toward the third point. We did the first two. And I want to turn toward the third point for a second and talk about one of the slogans under the third point. But first, I'll read you a little bit of the introduction to the third point. Transform bad circumstances into the path. There's an old Zen saying, the whole world is upside down. In other words, the way that the world looks from the ordinary or conventional point of view is pretty much the opposite of the way the world actually is. At least that's what the Zen masters have said. And there's a story that illustrates this. Once upon a time, there was a Zen master who came to be known as the Bird's Nest Roshi. And this is because he meditated in an eagle's nest at the top of a tree, you know, out on a limb, so to speak, which was, would appear, a dangerous thing to do. One gust of wind, one sleepy moment, and that was all for him. And so you can imagine he became quite famous for doing this practice, and people would come to visit him, you know, amazed at his nerve. And there's a famous meeting between this Bird's Nest Roshi and Sushir, who was one of maybe the greatest of all Chinese poets. And like many other Chinese poets, Sushir was also a government official who was at court and involved in government bureaucracy. In our country, poets usually are not in the government. In fact, it's the opposite. You know, poets would like never even go near the government, and no government person would ever think that a poet could have anything whatsoever to offer to the government. But in Chinese culture, they assumed that if you were a poet, of course you should be ruling the country. I like that idea. It's a good idea. Or not. Maybe it's not a good idea. Anyway, Sushir was a government official. So he once came to visit the Bird's Nest Roshi, and he was standing on the ground looking up at him up in the tree. And he said to him, you know, this is so dangerous. You know, why are you doing this? And the Bird's Nest Roshi looked down at him and said, you call this dangerous? What you're doing is way more dangerous. Living normally in the world, ignoring death, impermanence, loss, and suffering, as we all routinely do, as if this were a normal and safe way to live, is actually and literally much more dangerous than going out on a limb to meditate and confront your actual life. As we have been saying, you know, this whole weekend, while trying to avoid difficulty may be natural and understandable, and we shouldn't blame ourselves for it, the truth is that it does not work. We think that it makes sense to protect ourselves from pain, but we learn finally that our self-protection ends up causing us deeper pain. We think that it makes sense for us to hold on to what we have, but we learn eventually that our very holding on causes us to lose what we have. We're attached to what we like. We try to avoid what we don't like, but we just can't not seem to keep the attractive object in view, and we cannot seem to avoid the unwanted. So, even though it's not what our impulse dictates, avoiding life's difficulties is actually not the path of least resistance. It is the dangerous way to live. If you want to have a full and happy life in good times and in bad times, you have to get used to the idea that facing misfortune squarely is better than trying to escape from it. And this is not a matter of grimly focusing on life's difficulties. It is simply the smoothest possible approach to happiness. As we've already learned through the practice of sending and receiving, being willing to breathe in difficulty and transform it into healing and even joy is much better than fruitlessly trying to escape from it. Of course, if you can prevent difficulty, you do it. The world may be upside down, but we still have to live in this upside down world, and we have to be practical on its terms. So yes, we should try to protect our investments. Please do get regular checkups. Go to the gym, get exercise, eat organic, plenty of fruits and vegetables, get homeowners insurance, and so on and so on. This does not deny any of that. Instead, what it is addressing is the underlying attitude of anxiety, fear, and narrow-mindedness that most of us naturally have in the world we live in. And these underlying attitudes are making us unhappy, fearful, full of anxiety, needing to distract ourselves, physically ill, and small. We don't have to do that. So that's the argument for why we need to turn our mishaps into the path. So one of my favorite slogans, and this is a very famous one in the text, anybody who's ever looked at this text will remember this slogan. Drive all blames into one. Drive all blames into one. So again, somebody asked, what's the difference between my commentary to this text and the many other commentaries from the Tibetan tradition? And I said, the main difference is that when they tell stories about Tibetan lamas, I tell stories about Zen monastics. That's the difference. Otherwise, they're probably the same. So here's another story. Some of you who have practiced Zen will know that there's a formal eating ritual in Zen. This is one reason why a lot of people don't like Zen, because they say, oh my God, all that ritual, you know, oh, it's terrible. It's really a drag. You can't just go in and eat. You got to eat in this way, this. Everything is so detailed, it drives you crazy. And it's true. In Zen monasteries, I lived a number of years in a monastery in the United States here in California, and we ate all our meals except for one day a week. We had a day off meal, not in the meditation hall, not in formal style. Every other meal was in this formal style, which we call orioki, which is the name of the bowls. So you're sitting in meditation on cushions on a raised platform. There's formal serving, there's chanting, there's eating in a very dignified and prescribed style. This is where you put your chopsticks, this is where you put your spoon, this is what you do first, this is what you do second. And the ritual even includes water being passed out, served to each person so that you can wash your bowls with a special stick that you are given for the purpose, and then you can wipe the bowls and put them away. At first, this practice seems intimidating and way too complicated and even like diabolical. You think to yourself, like, are they doing this to make me crazy? Is this the purpose of this ritual? But when you do it for a while and it becomes second nature, you realize that not only is it incredibly beautiful, but it's actually the most efficient way ever devised for 50 or 60 people to eat a meal, be served a meal, eat a meal, have a full religious ritual, and wash and put away the dishes in about 45 minutes. That's pretty amazing, right? Serve the meal, eat the meal, have a religious ritual, wash and put away the dishes, all for 50 or 60 people, all in about 45 minutes. It's really elegant, actually. Actually, it's a little bit like mind training itself, which seems at first so complicated. But when you get used to it, you see how beautiful and even how simple and natural it actually is. It's actually, the analogy is pretty good now that I think about it. I'm glad I thought of that. Because it really is like that. At first, you look at this book and you hear all this stuff and it seems, oh man, it's so demanding and so confusing. But after a while, when you get into it, it's the most natural thing in the world. It's easy. Anyway, all of that is a background to this story that I'm about to tell you. So the story is, it's an oryoki formal meal in China, in ancient China. The abbot, who's a very important person, you know, iconic person in the mandala of the monastery, is eating the soup, and there's a snake's head, a head of a snake, in the soup. This was not supposed to be snake soup. Because Chinese monasteries are vegetarian, so there's no snake soup. This was some kind of mistake. Probably what happened is that the farmer monk out in the fields had not noticed that when he grabbed a bunch of greens and lopped them off with his curved knife, he also grabbed a snake and cut off the snake head and threw the greens in a big basket and didn't realize that that had happened. And the soup cooking monk, who was in charge of making this giant vat of soup for the many monastics, didn't notice when he threw the greens into the soup that there was a snake's head in the soup. And the serving monk, who was going around with the ladle in the soup, didn't notice that he had just served a snake's head to the abbot. And these things do happen, I know, because we had an organic farm on our one of our temples has an organic farm. And I remember, I'll never forget, one time we were having a series of talks by the various monastics about the precepts. And one monastic who was at the time the head of the farm, organic farm, no pesticides, we kill nothing to make this food. He came and gave a talk on the precept of not killing and detailed all the things that he had killed that morning on the organic farm to produce the food. Like, he didn't see when he was running down the rows in the tractor that there was a killdeer's nest, and he ran over the killdeer's nest, and by the time he realized that it was too late, the gophers, et cetera, things that were killed inadvertently in the process of growing food. You don't think that when you eat a carrot, nothing died. An organic carrot. Everything. You can't eat anything without killing something. That was an aside. Has nothing to do with the story. Anyway, here's the snake head in the soup. And this is bad. You do not want to serve the abbot in a Chinese monastery a snake's head. So the abbot calls in the head cook, who's not the farmer cook, who's not the soup-making cook. This is like the head chef, you know, who doesn't cook probably, but oversees everything. So he calls in the tenzo, the head cook, and he says, look, and he holds up the snake head. And the head cook doesn't say a single word. He snatches the snake's head from out of the abbot's hand, swallows it, and walks out. And that's the story. He doesn't blame the farmer. He doesn't blame the soup cook. He doesn't say any word of excuse. He doesn't feel guilty. He doesn't feel ashamed. He eats the blame. He eats the blame. And it was probably very nourishing. Drive all blames into one means we eat the blame no matter what happens. Because it wasn't really the Tenzo's fault, right? He could have blamed everybody else. But this is tricky, because blaming ourselves, which seems to be what the slogan is recommending, is not exactly blaming ourselves in the ordinary sense. We all know perfectly well how to blame ourselves. We've been doing this all our lives, constantly feeling guilty about everything, and if not guilty, then ashamed. We do not need Buddhist slogans to tell us how to do this. But this is not what the slogan means. And this is really important and powerful when you think about it. Drive all blames into one means that you cannot blame anyone for what happens, even if it actually appears to be someone's fault, like the farmer's fault or the soup cook's fault. It may be their fault, but you actually can't blame them. Something happened, and since it did, there's nothing else to be done but to make use of it. Everything that happens, disastrous though it may be, and no matter whose fault it was, has a potential benefit, no matter how bad it may seem at first. And that's the nature of anything that happens. That's what it means that something happens. It means that it has a potential benefit. And that's your job. If you're there and it's in your life and it happened to you, your job is to figure out what is the potential benefit. Drive all blames into one means that you take full appreciation and full responsibility for everything that arises in your life, no matter whose fault it is. This that just happened is terrible. This is not what I wanted. This brings with it many, many tragedies and problems. But what am I going to do with it? What can I learn from it? How can I grow? How do I make use of it for the path? These are the only questions worth asking. And the only one who can answer these questions is you. Furthermore, you can answer them. You do have the strength and the capacity. Drive all blames into one is a tremendous practice of cutting through the long human habit of whining and complaining, and finding on the other side of all that whining and complaining strength to turn every situation into the path. Blaming others and blaming yourself are not really that different when you examine them. How is it possible to blame yourself? The only way you could do it is by standing next to yourself, wagging your finger at yourself, just the way you wag your finger at somebody else that you're blaming for something. Blaming yourself requires that you somehow stand outside yourself so you can make yourself into somebody else that you could blame. I mean, it's a ridiculous thought, but this is what happens. In other words, there's no way to be self-blaming or self-incriminating without self-externalizing. Self-judging is self-externalizing. But the question is, who is standing over there wagging whose finger at who? So it doesn't matter. In other words, we might say, well, I'm noble. I don't blame the other people. I only blame myself. But actually, blaming yourself is just the same as blaming somebody else. That's what I'm trying to say here. It doesn't matter who you blame, whether it's yourself or somebody else. As long as there's blame, it's an excuse not to take responsibility. We think we're taking responsibility when we blame ourselves and eat ourselves up with guilt and remorse, but that's exactly not taking responsibility. The important thing here is to accept that what has happened actually has happened. You eat the snake's head. You accept reality. You accept responsibility. Now what? That's your job. And what if okay, you heard me say this, fine, but what if actually you can't do it? Every time something happens that you blame yourself, what if that happens? Then, well, we know just what to do. Breathe in the suffering of your self-blame. Breathe out healing and relief for yourself. Try your best to stay present and patient, and don't let your mind run away with you. Here you are. This is it. It's not some other way. It's this way. There is no place else that you could go but forward into the next moment. Drive all blames into one. Drive all blames into one. So that's a good slogan. I recommend it.
Can you repeat that once more?
Drive all blames into one? Yeah. Drive all blames into one. These words, by the way, are the words of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He many years ago gave teachings on this text. His book on the text is actually still available from the 1970s, and he is the one responsible for these very imaginative English versions of the slogans. And I think a lot of people who have commented on the text in English have used his translations of some of the slogans because they're so pungent, you know. I think it's called Training the Mind or something like that. I think it has the word training in it, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure it's Training the Mind. Yeah. Okay, maybe I'll do one more and then we can do some feedback exercises. This one is in the sixth point, the discipline of relationship. I think maybe these are short, so I'll do two of these. Don't be a phony. Don't be a phony. We're all tempted when we take up spiritual practice to imagine that because we've done that, it makes us somehow different from the ordinary run of people. We are spiritual people. We are not like those unspiritual others. So naturally, we feel differently about ourselves and we act differently. We are very, very kind. We are very, very nice. We always have a smile. We're extremely mindful about almost everything. Very deliberate in our speech and action, and possibly slightly stiff. Which is completely typical. If you go to a Zen monastery, where there are many opportunities to be mindful and kind and so on, you'll notice that mostly it's the newer monastics who are like this. Certainly that was the case where I lived in the Zen center for a long time. You know, I lived in a residential Zen center. And you could tell the newer students because they were very, very good at their practice. Very careful with the Zen forms, very precise, very polite. They were perfect and stiff. So it's not that there's something wrong with being stiff. But the point is, if you're going to revolutionize your life, you know, we should revolutionize our lives. Let's do it. That's good. But, and this is really important, and it goes beyond like a stylistic problem with there's something wrong with being stiff. The point is, don't impose some sort of spiritualistic regimen on yourself. Don't impose a kind of idealistic idea, you know, on your life. Don't be a phony. In fact, as you go on with your practice, you begin to see that the spiritual process is exactly the opposite of this. You realize at some point, after you are, you know, for a while, maybe a decade or two, imposing this kind of like spiritual regimen on yourself, it strikes you at some point that actually, before you took up spiritual practice, you were already imposing a regimen on yourself. Your entire life, you were imposing a regimen on yourself, which you took to be yourself. And that actually, spiritual practice is the practice of finally stop doing that. Actually, relax. Because you don't have to impress anyone, much less yourself. Don't be a phony. Remove all regimens and just be honest about what's going on and who you are. So this means when you practice, don't be a phony. It means that you will notice every time that you are imposing something on yourself. Every time you notice that your efforts to be good and practice slogans and be compassionate begins to feel like you're wearing a straitjacket. And this happens, right? Don't you notice this? You're practicing along, and all of a sudden it feels like this is so restrictive, this practice. Then you remember, don't be a phony. And then maybe take a break. Take it easy. Watch a nice television show. There's very good television shows now, you know. There are. Because all the most brilliant people who are students of Harvard and Yale and MIT and NYU and all these prestigious colleges are going straight to Hollywood to write the new shows that we're seeing on Netflix. I was talking to Joe, you know, some of them actually go from Columbia University to Washington, D.C., where they work as congressional aides, but what they're really doing is gathering material for the shows that they're going to write about Washington. Or Wall Street. They go work in Wall Street so they can write the shows. So watch one of those shows. They're quite good, and they're fun. Have a glass of wine. Relax. Don't be so fixated on being good and pure and a perfect practitioner. Don't be a phony. One more, and then we'll stop. Don't talk about faults. F-A-U-L-T-S. Don't talk about faults. So if you were to practice this slogan as an absolute literal rule, it would probably do wonders for your human relationships. Imagine what it would be like if you never, ever, under any circumstances, discussed the faults of others. See if you could try this for a week or even a few days. And if you tried it, you would discover, as you seem to already understand, how shocking it is that almost every conversation you're in involves discussing the faults of others, especially when you consider that others includes people in the government, etc., etc. Not only people one knows personally, right? Imagine never discussing the faults of others. If you could do this, probably the effect of it is that you would become an unusually likable person. And other people, without knowing why, would be drawn to you. Because it is so normal for all of us to speak critically, even disparagingly, about one another. Friends do it about friends. And although we all enjoy this sort of seemingly innocent gossip What I think is that even though we don't know this, it actually makes us quite nervous deep inside. Because as you and I are talking about her, we're probably thinking later on when you and I have conversations with her, will we be talking about you? Right? We all know this. And so, you know, even while we're in those conversations, we're nervous about it. It makes us slightly nervous. And this makes us, I think, typically somewhat wary of one another all the time. I'm not talking about like some raging paranoia. I'm just talking about a very low-grade level of wariness that we have with each and every person we meet, even the people we love the most. And this wariness is so normal that we don't even see it as wariness. So a person who absolutely didn't do this, a person who would seem to be genuinely, consistently, you know, forgiving and supportive, would stand out like a sore thumb. But the obvious problem is, you know, well, what about when somebody actually is at fault? They have faults. I mean, it happens a lot. Or what about when it becomes impossibly awkward socially in the middle of a conversation not to participate, you know, in discussing the faults of others? What would you do then? You'd be a phony, right? So the fact is, when someone is acting badly, and people do, when they're being nasty, obnoxious, corrupt, cruel, or even just stupid or incompetent, you're speaking about that person's faults in a critical way, however deserving of such speech the person may actually be, will not help. It will just make the situation worse. This is so whether you speak to the person directly or whether you snipe behind his or her back, and the person eventually will discover this or sense it from the way that the people you've been talking to now react to him or her. The effect of this criticism is that the person will get upset, feel under attack, which then will inspire him or her to continue to behave in the same vein. The traditional Tibetan wording for this slogan is very telling and very moving, actually. The traditional wording is, don't speak of injured limbs. Don't speak of injured limbs. And the concept here is that everyone who acts or speaks destructively or foolishly or even incompetently is like a person with an injured limb. If you see someone with a deformed hip or with stumps for arms walking down the street, the injury that they have is obvious. And just as we don't criticize someone for having an injury like that, although we recognize that it really is an injury and that there are limitations that come from that injury, just as we don't criticize that person for their injury, we also aren't critical of the person with an inner injury that is the ultimate cause of that person's poor conduct. In just the same way, we can recognize the injury and the limitations that it engenders, and we can respect them. You can always count on the fact that people who behave badly have been injured. If you need to correct them in some way, you can do so with that in mind, with some sympathy. Such people need to figure out how to deal with their wounds someday. And very likely, your speaking to them or about them harshly and with disrespect will not bring that day about. It won't inspire them. It won't inspire you or other listeners. In fact, the opposite will be the case. Speaking to or about a wounded, nasty person with kindness and warmth, when that person has been conditioned by almost all of his or her relationships to expect the opposite, speaking in the heat of the moment with kindness and respect could cause a surprising transformation. But it's hard to do if you don't see the injury in the first place and appreciate it. If you only see the fault and not the injury, then it would just be being a phony to do that. So to practice, don't talk about faults would involve noticing when you are doing this, remembering that there's an injury behind every fault, looking for it and seeing it and softening, and then maybe conditioning yourself little by little to speak differently. And this, by the way, is equally as true about oneself. When you yourself are being harsh and angry, turn around and look for the wound in you that's causing you to behave in that way. And maybe when you do that with yourself, it helps you to see that this is true also for everyone else. So let's see. Drive all blames into one. Don't be a phony. Don't talk about faults. Did I do another one? That was all. Yeah, what's that? That was the main point, and these are the three slogans, yeah. Yeah, so let's do what we did on Saturday. Let's all stand up and take a stretch, and then we're going to each find a partner, someone to talk to.